Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Celia Imrie, instantly recognisable as one of Britain's most versatile actresses. She's worked in television, theatre and films for the past four decades. Roles at the Royal Shakespeare Company and in big-budget movies, yes, but it's her instinct for TV comedy that has made her a household name. First in Acorn Antiques and then Dinner Ladies. The sound of people laughing is a bit like being drunk, she says. I'd rather they laughed at me than be silent. As a child, she dreamt of becoming a ballerina, but she was considered not to be the right shape for classical ballet, and after suffering the bitter disappointment of rejection, turned to acting. Her film credits include Bridget Jones's Diary, Nanny McPhee, and Calendar Girls. In the latter, she had to pose topless with only some delicately placed patisserie sparing her blushes. She says, "I don't like taking my clothes off in front of myself, leave alone anyone else." So shooting that scene, Celia Imrie, was a tricky moment in your long and distinguished career, was it?
It really was. Something that we all were sort of dreading, I suppose. We all woke up that morning like it was an exam. But I suppose I had the advantage of being first, so get it over and done with.
Right, and you did look, you were in your early 50s at that point. You looked in terrific shape. Had you done that usual star thing of the zone diet and down at the gym for an hour and a half every day for 6 months prior?
Yes, we all suddenly were crammed into the gym. I loathe gyms, actually. Right. We were all swimming at 6 o'clock in the morning. And it was, you know, the real dare of all, except that with Helen Mirren at the helm, she sort of led us through most brilliantly. You know, of course it was a relief, and we had a glass of champagne when we'd all done it, you know, like 10-pin bowling. We were one down, nine to go. And I was mighty glad to get it over and done with.
And what about the response to the movie? I mean, it was a big hit, and people, I think, that, you know, that sense of a celebration of women of a certain age, of them actually having a ruddy good time and making a bit of a splash. People really responded to that.
Yes, and we had the real Calendar Girls around us a lot, so we had their sort of spirit encouraging us.
Can you go about your business these days? Can you go with your... I'm sure you don't wear a headscarf or even anything as unbecoming as that, but do you go to the supermarket and do all those things?
Oh, yes, of course I do. It depends whether I'm wearing lipstick or not, actually, but I was out strolling, minding my own business by the sea one day when somebody shouted out, "Oh, look, it's Bigger Bonds."
Yes, they needed bigger buns for you. You're talking there about Calendar Girls. Did they need to go out and get bigger buns to
that
shield
was in
your
the
modesty?
Script, so yes, I suppose.
Right. And so you've got this. You've got a fabulously chiselled look to your face, and you have this when you choose to really ramp it up, quite a cut glass accent. Yet your first role in performance was as a rat.
Yes, and funnily enough, I found the programme the other day, and I was also a sausage in that particular pantomime. How on earth I danced as one, I don't know. But yes, that was my first as a chorus girl.
And yes, as a chorus girl. Now, you're known for playing characters that seem on the surface to be terribly sort of proper, but actually underneath are a little bit nutty. And I have to say, your choices today don't disappoint. This is an unusual selection of music we're about to hear. What's the basis for your selection?
Well, looking through them again, they're a great mixture between ones that really cheer me up and get me dancing, and ones that are terribly sad.
Tell us what we're going to hear first, Celia Imrie.
The first one is a song I've always adored called "Is That All There Is?" I love it sung by Peggy Lee, but I've just recently heard Bette Midler sing it, and she tips the scales. I think she's wonderful.
Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is.
That was Bette Midler with Is That All There Is? When people think of you, Celia Imrie, automatically they also think of Victoria Wood. You have worked so successfully with her over the years, not least on Acorn Antiques, which was such a big hit on TV and then went on to be a hit on stage. You won an Olivier Award for your performance in that, which by many critics' estimation was actually the scene stealer. Did you enjoy that on stage?
Yes, of course. Actually, at the beginning, because Victoria had been so clever in writing just a tiny little snippet each week, I think it was only about 6 minutes long, and then when she told me she was going to write a musical of sort of 2.5 hours long, I must say I was a bit worried. I didn't know how that was going to work. But anyway, needless to say, it did, and I was absolutely thrilled to be a part of it.
And when had you first met then? How far back did you go?
Blimey, probably about 30 years ago, actually. A friend of mine was at university with her, but I think she thought of me more as a chorus girl until, luckily, one night she saw a sketch show that I'd done in Scotland and then asked me to come on her show, which, of course, you know, I jumped at.
Yes, and Acorn Antiques itself, it is, I mean, a great pleasure for many of us over the years. It was a very quirky and odd thing. Did you understand it from the minute you read it on the page?
I did, but the cameramen didn't. I do remember the cameramen watching what had been a very slick show up until Acorn Antiques, and then them just thinking, why is this bit so bad? Why don't they know their lines? Why is she picking up the telephone and it's still ringing? And why is the scenery swaying in the background? But gradually they got into it and they put the booms too low so Duncan's head banged into them. Cleverly, Jeff Posner, our brilliant director, never let us do it live. Might have been a disaster. There was a moment when Victoria, Duncan and I were all on a two-seater sofa, really closely together, on the occasion when Julie Walters came in her lime green leotard, because the whole of the antique shop had been turned into a health farm for no reason at all. That was impossibly difficult. And, of course, we all set each other off.
Yes. It seems quite close to the surface, your laughter. Are you a giggler? Are you?
Well, yes, but funnily enough, I think really good work happens when people are all having a good time, which we did.
And she also wrote for you the part of Philippa in Dinner Ladies. Again, another terrific part with some of the best lines. I don't know if we can say them on Radio 4, but I've written down a couple here, which I was enjoying only yesterday. Absolutely right round the buggering twist in one of them.
Well, yes. You see, the thing about Vic is so marvellous. She heard me one day when I was late to rehearsals, screaming down the phone, trying to get a taxi. And the very next week, it was all in the episode. I think that's where it comes from.
Is that
from.
Where it comes from?
Yes, and I think I probably said something worse.
Yes, there's another one which I definitely know I can't say, was that terrifically funny. Let's have some more music then. What are we going to hear now? We're on disc number 2, Celia.
We're going to have, just to make us laugh, we're going to have Darlene and Jonathan Edwards singing Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
Yes, now, as I said, some of your choices are on the quirky side. Explain to people what they're about to hear, because it's important you understand what they're hearing.
Yes, well, it's Jo Stafford, who's an absolutely brilliant singer, and her husband, and who is a brilliant pianist. You have to be, like Les Dawson, be good to be bad. And this is what they are. It's heaven.
Tiptoe to the window, by the window, that is where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me. Tiptoe from your pillow to the shadow of the willow tree, and tiptoe through the tulips with me.
That was Darlene and Jonathan Edward and Tiptoe Through the Tulips. Have you composed yourself, Celia Imrie?
But it made us both laugh, didn't it?
Yes. Oh, quite a peculiar sound they conjured up there. You are known for playing these very proper characters, and your background would seem to denote that, you know, you had the right stock for playing proper characters. You were born in Surrey, in Guildford in Surrey, 1952. You were the fourth of five children, and your father, was he a doctor?
Radiologist.
Radiologist, yes, right. Yeah. And your father was quite old when you were born.
He was 60.
What sort of character was he?
Somebody said he was a gentle giant, which I think is very good, actually. He was also known as the galloping doctor on Epsom Downs. He used to ride off on horseback to the jockeys to see if they'd broken any bones. He was quite strict, though, you know, quite a strict Scot, but he always wanted children. But I think possibly When all five of us came along, we were a bit of a noise for him.
Right.
And we had patients to the house, so we all had to be on our best behaviour.
Right. Your mother was 20 years younger. So
20 years younger, yes.
Right. And,
yes.
And what was she like?
Well, she's an inspiration to all my parts, actually.
Is she?
Yeah. She was a really good sport. She loved the races and she loved parties. She played the violin. She was quite a toff and my father wasn't. So it was sort of a marvellous mixture, really.
And was your mother glamorous?
I thought so. Yes. Well, she had that marvellous thing of sort of not caring what she looked like in the daytime. But then if she'd be going out and come and kiss us goodnight, she'd be the swish of red chiffon, I remember, and crystal necklace
right.
and perfume.
And this, I mean, it sounds like a stable and idyllic upbringing. What were your parents' ambitions for you and your siblings?
Well, luckily, two of my sisters became nurses, which my father was very pleased about. And one day he did say to me, "So when are you going to go to the secretarial college and be a secretary?" And I remember looking at the back of his head and thinking, how am I ever going to tell him I'm never going to do that?
Yes.
He didn't really approve. And so I did placate them all by doing a dancing teacher's course.
And when you were a little girl, were you, were you mischievous? Were you a cheeky sort? You've got that little twinkle of mischievousness about you,
good.
I think.
I hope so. Well, yes, I think I probably was. I mean, I suppose being 4 out of 5, you did spend quite a lot of time saying, hello, which is why I've spent my life doing it, I suppose, continually.
Is it true that you once tipped a painting easel that was joined to 20 other painting easels just to watch them all go down?
I'm afraid it was. Mm. Yes, I've got the devil in me somewhere just to see what would happen. I don't think I owned up. I think I went off to lunch.
How satisfying.
Don't.
Let's have some more music then. What's next?
The next one is for my father, Jimmy Shand and his reel.
And why have you chosen this then? Are memories attached to it?
Yes, actually. My father was the most wonderful Scottish dancer. And one of my best memories at home was in the summertime, peeping out of the window upstairs and seeing them all on the lawn, kilts flying.
Jimmy Shand and Mrs. Chumley's reel. And memories for you, Celia Imrie, of reels on the lawn there. You would watch, was it some sort of Surrey Society of Scots or something?
Well, actually,
you were watching?
Yes, I believe my father did start the Scottish Society in Guildford. So
right.
He was very much the leader of it.
And you've called your son Angus. Do you sit down and compulsorily make him listen to Jimmy Shand's reels then? Just as
No, but it's as when we were listening to it, you can't keep still, can you? It's just heaven. It's sort of in your blood, I think.
Right.
And Angus, funnily enough, when he was born, he looked just like my father. It's a weird thing to say, but he really did. And that combined with I couldn't be bothered to go through the name book very far. I stopped today.
Right. And your first love then as a little girl was ballet, as I said in the introduction. What age did you start dancing?
5, I think, probably.
Oh, very young then.
I absolutely loved it. But of course, you know, for a ballet dancer, you have to be tiny and be able to be lifted up. And they absolutely realised I wasn't the right shape.
And when did that happen? What age were you when you were told that?
About 11, I suppose, when I started auditioning for all the ballet schools.
It's to do with the length of your bones and so on, and they can see how you're going to... When you say not the right shape, I mean, you're like a very slim person to me. You're talking about your height?
Everything, really.
Right. So you were 11 when you were told, and what do they do when you go to the auditions and so on? Do they just say to you, no, I'm sorry, you don't make the grade?
No, they would probably write to you, which is always more sort of, I don't know, I think it's worse in a way.
And so your mother had to tell you, did she?
No, she didn't. And funnily enough, I understand why she didn't. because it would be a very hard thing to do. I don't know what I was told, quite. But anyway, I found the letter in her writing desk. I shouldn't have been snooping, but I did. And they said, yes, she's very good, but I'm afraid she's going to be too big.
Right.
So I thought, oh, well, I'll get small then.
Right, yes. Tell me about getting small.
Well, it was a stupid thing to do, but I thought at a young age then, I'll get small and I won't eat so much, you know. I'm afraid what is now quite a common thing, I see girls in the street sometimes, it makes my heart break, because this anorexia thing, it's an awful thing, but you get yourself into it and only you can get yourself out of it. It is possible, and it upsets me when I hear so much talked about it now.
Right. What upsets you, that people misunderstand it, or that they...
I think the thing is, it's such a terrible waste of life, and also I regret dreadfully, you know, the embarrassment I caused my father, the upset I caused my mother and family.
And embarrassment with him, I suppose you mean with him being a doctor?
Yes, exactly. Why yes. can't you make her eat? You know, it was ridiculous. And it was sort of much more unusual then.
I mean, it was very serious for you, just to be clear. When you had anorexia, you were hospitalised with anorexia. Mm. And for how long?
About sort of 3 months or something. It was ghastly. Absolutely right. Ghastly. I don't wish it upon anybody. But I genuinely do believe it is possible to do it yourself. You have to sort of...
To get better.
Yes, take control and get yourself better. I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with me and say, oh, but it's an illness and everything.
Yes.
Yes, it is. And you do go so far down the line, it's very difficult to come back. But I absolutely believe that you can make yourself better. Right. I truly do believe that.
OK, that's a very... I mean, as you'll be aware saying that, there'll be a lot of people who won't just disagree, but... You know,
they'll be shouting at the wireless.
They will be shouting at the wireless.
No, I'm sure they will, but I'm absolutely stand by what I believe.
Because that was your experience with anorexia, that because in the end you healed yourself?
I mean, it was entirely myself, my own selfish act. I think it's a very aggressive thing for all the people around you. I think it's a terrible waste of time, and it's absolutely possible to get yourself back, I believe. I mean, I feel very much for the poor mothers.
Yes.
I spoke to a girl quite recently who came to visit me, and I said, where's your mother? And she said, downstairs. And I said, well, bring her up. And this worn-out woman met me. Because I think that people, I'm afraid, I think young girls get into a sort of habit and they stay there and they're happy to be in this utter misery. And it's such a shame.
So what would you tell? I mean, that's interesting that you even now have occasional contact with people. You choose to talk to people who are suffering or have suffered anorexia. What do you say to them then? What's your advice to them? You presumably don't just sit there and say, come on, pull yourself out of it.
No, I don't. I don't. But I do say it's entirely up to you, you know.
Right.
And also, a wonderful staff nurse said to me once, she said, you do realise you're taking up the bed of a really sick child, don't you? And it was the best thing she could have said, because actually it gave me a real, you know, kick.
And given that you're an actress, and given that, you know, part of the acting game is that, you know, it's as much, or maybe not as much to do with how you look, but how you look is a huge part of it. Is it always there and you're keeping the lid on it, or have you struggled with that throughout the years, or...?
How I look, you mean?
The idea of physical perfection and the idea of being good enough.
Yes, it's always there, really, I suppose. But there's so much else now in life, actually. Life's very precious. You just got to get on with it.
Let's have some more music then, Celia. What are we going to hear?
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, this is apparently the saddest song Elvis Presley ever heard. And it's sung by a wonderful singer, Winona Judd. And we're going to play the sort of... towards the end of it. Apparently she asked to go into the recording studio by herself in the dark and just sing it by herself, and it's absolutely heartbreaking.
The silence of a falling star lights up a purple sky, and as I walk
That was Winona Judd and I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. You said earlier, Celia Imrie, that many of the parts you play are somewhat inspired by your mother and memories of how your mother was when your mother was still alive. Did she ever talk to you about that, recognise herself in the parts that you played?
No, I don't think she did. There was a marvellous moment, actually, when she came to a recording of Akon Antiques, and Julie said to me, "Ask your mother if she understands that Akon Antiques isn't supposed to be very good," because she was sort of off with the fairies most of the time, my mother. So on the way home, I said, "Mums, do you understand that Akon Antiques isn't supposed to be very good?" And she said, "What, you mean you're not very good at selling antiques?" And I thought, well, I don't think I can say any more after that. But I did actually, I mean, there was one moment in Love in a Cold Climate when I discovered that Nancy Mitford's mother, who I was sort of based on, kept chickens in order to educate her daughters and sell the eggs. My mother did too. So I dressed exactly as she used to, with an old man's mac, old men's shoes, and a sort of awful hat on, and that's how she used to feed the chickens, so I got that in.
One of your early jobs was travelling, you were travelling around the country, I think, with Trevor Nunn's production of Hedda Gabler. That must have been incredibly instructive, I'm thinking, being behind the scenes on a production of that calibre.
Well, it was, because it was round the world.
Oh, round the world?
Round the world,
good
yes.
Grief.
And strangely enough, a friend of mine, Jane, said that there was this job going, assistant stage manager, which is sort of the tea girl, really, and understudying. And actually, I didn't really want to do it because I wanted to act and I wanted to have my own part and everything. But I'd never been abroad before, and it was going round the world, directed by Trevor Nunn and starring Glenda Jackson, you know, double Oscar winner, Jenny Lindon, Tim West, Patrick Stewart, Peter Eyre. Fantastic cast. I was Pam St. Clement's understudy. Anyway, I'm happy to say I jumped on board, and it was extraordinary.
And had you decided to become an actress because you knew you couldn't be a dancer? Was it just you needed to perform, you felt you wanted to perform? Was that a reaction to the...
Yes. Yes, I mean, anything showing off, I suppose, really.
And your father, as we know, had said to you, you know, when are you going to go to secretarial college? What was his response to you deciding to properly be an actress and try and make your living at it?
Well, he never really knew, actually. I mean, I know I've said this before, but he did one day say, "So when are you ever going to be on the Gogglebox?" Because he loved it. But sadly, he died before I ever was, which was Upstairs, Downstairs, my first television. So it was a bit like going on Cranford, I suppose, you know.
Which you have, of course,
yes,
been on. Given that you came from a very middle-class family, there were times in those early years when you were doing jobs like waitressing or you were charring people's houses and so on. Did you ever think, you know, coming from the nice background that you did, that actually this is not quite the thing and I'm going to give this up and get a proper job?
No, I thought it was quite a hoot, especially when I, at one point, I was charring for Arthur Schwartz, who gave me some very good advice when I left. My advice, Celia, is to make a nuisance of yourself.
Yes, I mean, let's talk about that. You're not averse to picking up the phone and bugging people into seeing you, or indeed with Cranford writing a part for you in that case.
Well, yes, I mean, I think you've got to sort of dare yourself sometimes. And actually, if you can do it with a joke, sort of a joke, I think that's the best way of doing it, but with a twinkle in your eye, so they can say no if they want to.
Let's have some music then. It's time for a disc, Celia Imrie. What are we going to hear next? We're on disc number 5 now.
Ah, yes. Well, this is my mother's favourite piece of music, and she played it on her violin. Thank you.
Fritz Kreisler and Schön Rosmarin, Beautiful Rosemary. You said your mother played that. She must have been pretty good.
She was absolutely wonderful, and she used to play Irish jigs and Scottish reels as well.
She died 10 years ago. She was in her mid-80s. Did she talk to you about your career? Was she interested proud?
She was wonderfully encouraging, but she also, I mean, I think she was surrounded by rather disapproving friends, let's put it like that, at the beginning, you know, this daughter on the stage, what is she up to? And my mother was very careful because she never really talked about what I was doing or what I was up to them. But she was wonderfully encouraging.
You played in Mark Hatton's Polar Bears just last year. You played the part of a mother struggling to understand her child's manic depression. And I'm thinking there of, you know, you were talking about suffering severely from anorexia in your teens. Did you mine a little bit of that experience for the performance?
I think I did, actually, because I remember my darling mother coming across from Waterloo Station to visit me practically every day. It must have been ghastly for her. Mm-hmm. You know, very, very difficult to understand. So, yes, I suppose, I based myself on my mother, and it is difficult to understand your child suffering.
Did you ever say sorry to your mother for what you felt you had put her through?
I hope I did.
Mm. Okay. You were 42 yourself when you became a mother. Did you find that helped to change your focus? Of course, it's a wonderful thing for sort of taking the spotlight off oneself when you have children. There's an awful lot more to worry about.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd always wanted to have a child, and it does. It stops you being so selfish, because I suppose our acting career is quite selfish, because having a child, acting is no longer the whole point.
You said you always wanted to have children, but you've also said in the past that getting married gives you the heebie-jeebies. You have done it as a single parent, which is terrifically hard work. How have you found that?
I have. Well, Ben Whitrow, who is Angus's father, is the most wonderful father to Angus.
He's an actor, of course.
Yes, and he has two wonderful half-brother and sister, Hannah and Tom, who've been absolutely wonderful to him too. You see, the thing is, how do I know what marriage is like? I've never even tried it. But I imagine it, you know, childishly, that it's a bit of a trap. And so I've always been fiercely independent and wanted to do it on my own. Hopefully it's going all right so far.
And he acts with you in Kingdom on ITV. Yes.
He's a very good little actor. And like his grandfather, who he never knew, sadly, is very modest. I think he's a very good little actor, and I would never put him off. It's a great life.
Let's have some more music. What's next, Celia?
Oh, yes. Now, this is heaven. Barbara Windsor singing It's So Much Nicer in Nice from The Boyfriend.
Why have you chosen this?
Well, A, it makes me roar with laughter. It's a part that I've played twice, actually, but never as brilliantly as I can hear Barbara Windsor does it. And also because I'm mad about the film. It's brilliant. But this is a total highlight.
They say it's lovely weather, young ladies in Vienna, but it's nicer, much nicer in Nice. In Amsterdam or Brussels, the men have great big muscles, but they're nicer, much nicer in Nice. I've heard that the Italians are very fond of dalliance, and they're all so keen on eating glaze. But whatever they may say, this is where I want to stay, for it's so much nicer in Nice.
She says it's nicer, much nicer in Nice.
That was Barbara Windsor singing It's Nicer in Nice from The Boyfriend. We should remind people, Celia Imrie, that there has been, of course, plenty of serious work in your CV. Films, Hilary and Jackie, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. You were very well reviewed in Edward Bond's The Sea. You picked up the Clarence Derwent Award for that. You were also in School for Scandal. Does it bother you that when I introduce you and when people see you that they think of Dinner Ladies and Acorn Antiques, that you are known for the lighter parts of your repertoire?
No, I'm very proud, actually, and I love it that people know me as Miss Babs. But I've got lots more underneath, and I yearn to play, you know, more serious, heavy dramas.
Do you?
Actually.
And what about some of the... I mentioned that you'd played the Royal Shakespeare Company. What about some of the big classical roles? Do you still have your eye on those?
I do, actually.
What do you fancy?
I better not say, because otherwise it'll all go wrong. I'm terribly superstitious. But, no, I'd love to have a crack. course.
Now, tell me about the group of women that you've recently been filming with. And it's got a terrifically complex name. I'm sure I'll muck it up if I try and say it. What have you been filming recently?
I've been filming the best exotic marigold hotel in India.
Who's in the cast?
Dame Judi Dench, Dame Maggie Smith, Penelope Wilton, Bill Nye, Tom Wilkinson, Ronnie Pickup, Dev Patel, and me.
Are you part of this sort of tremendous... You mentioned there's a couple... Is that a couple of dames in there?
A couple of dames.
Yes. So you're part of this club of women who sort of seem to represent the best of what British acting has to offer. When you're... I know what you're going to say. You're going to say when you're acting together, they're all very giving and you get on terribly well. I'm really wondering if... Is there a little bit of competition? Are you slightly stealing somebody's lights or putting in an extra word here and there?
If ever we did any of that, it would be making each other laugh. But it's all done with fun. And actually, it was like a dream. I can't quite believe I did it, actually, but I did.
Let's have some more music, then. What are we going to hear now?
This is my favourite opera, with Maria Callas playing Tosca and Tito Gobbi in the end of the second act of Tosca.
Yes, and tell me, why have you chosen the end of the second act?
Well, there's a wonderful film. I think Zeffirelli filmed it. And this is the moment when she knifes... Well, Tito Gobbi, anyway. And so you hear him fall to the ground, but it's so dramatic.
It's Baron Scarpia, I think, who gets it.
And she's a fabulous, fabulous actress.
That was the end of the second act of Puccini's Tosca with Maria Callas and Tito Gobbi with the Paris Conservatoire Orchestra conducted by Georges Prêtre. You've spoken about, you know, enjoying sort of feeling the fear, the idea that you're not terrified that you don't know what's coming next. Are you a very independent person, do you think?
I hope I am. More so now, I think. I love the sort of gamble of life, not knowing what's happening next. I don't know whether that's my mother dragging me to the racecourse when I was little. I'm not sure. But I do love not knowing.
And I'm wondering also then with Angus, as he's a teenager now and you have happy times and good times working with him, you don't suffer the idea that suddenly he's going to be 18 and before you know it he's going to be off and he might give me a phone call once a week, but that'll
be
it.
I better not think about that at the moment. The one thing I do think, though, is that I don't want to get very old and him to have to look after me. I'd find that rather grim. Mm.
You think the only son with the mother and the...
Yes, yeah. I think it would be sad for him. I mean, I know, you know, when my own mother was older, you know, it's not very dignified. You know, she was a real fighter. And I think possibly she decided, oh, I've had enough of this. And I don't know whether one is allowed to decide when to go. I don't know. But I just... That sounds awfully morbid, all this. But I don't want him to be lumbered with me. Mm. I want him to go off and enjoy his life.
Do you have a plan?
No plan at all. Right. Except that I might like to go and live abroad when I'm older, perhaps. I don't know.
Okay. Well, you'll be on the island, of course.
Yes.
I mean, that is abroad.
Oh, yes.
Gosh. How are you going to cope on the island?
Well, I think I'm better at being on my own now than I used to be. Mm. I'm not sure how practical I'd be, but I think I would be easier with myself being alone than I used to be years ago.
And will there be dancing on this island?
Oh, Lord, all the time. All day long. You know, any music makes me dance, actually, except that now I don't have the balance that I used to have. So the chances are I will topple over. But if nobody's there, then I won't crash into anything.
Let's have your final piece then, Celia Imrie. What's disc number 8?
Well, I'll definitely be marching to this. It's the Royal Artillery Orchestra and the March of the Toys. We'll be right back.
That was the Royal Artillery Orchestra and March of the Toys. So, Celia, here we are with the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare and your book. What book will you take?
I'd like to take the Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable, because it tells you all about the sort of medieval swear words you can use. I love dictionaries. The idea of a dictionary would be delicious.
Right, that's yours. And your luxury.
That was quite difficult, actually, but it came to me just yesterday. And I would like to have a cut glass crystal chandelier, because it'll reflect all the sunshine, right, and make, this is what I'm imagining, or patterns on the sand.
Yes.
It'll reflect the moon and the stars at night and keep me company. And then I can pick off a prism every now and again and lay it on some twigs and light a fire, you know, with the sun on,
yes,
the glass. And then I could sort of make rainbows with it.
Right. Do you want candles in that as well?
For a moon? Am I allowed? I'd have to have,
are,
wouldn't I?
Yes,
because it'd be no electricity. Yes, please.
Right. Okay, it's yours. And if you had to choose just one of the eight from today, which one would you choose?
Do you know, impossibly difficult, but it made me laugh so much. I'm going to go for Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
Right.
Please.
It's yours. Celia Imrie, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
It's been lovely. Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.